We began in a garden. We end in a city, where we and all of creation are redeemed, liberated, made new. God is in the house this morning. Would you please stand to honor him while he speaks his word to you? Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men. They will be his people, and God himself will be their God. He will dry every tear away from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the former things have passed away." The very words of God. You may be seated. We began in a garden. We end in a city, where we and all of creation are redeemed, liberated, made new. A city. The new Jerusalem. God's greatest city. A city that meant so much to those who first heard the words of the book of Revelation. Because the city, the new Jerusalem, told those people something they desperately needed to hear. The city, the new Jerusalem, told them God wins. The new Jerusalem tells them God wins. Come with me. Back to the first century, back to those first people who heard the words of the book of Revelation. If you go back early in the book of Revelation, you discover that the people are being abused. The church is being persecuted. People are losing their jobs because they're following Jesus. They're being beaten, thrown into prison, and some are dying for their faith. And as all that's going on, people are beginning to wonder, these followers of Jesus are beginning to wonder, who really does rule? Who really does reign? Who really does win? Does God rule? Does God reign? Does God win? Or could it be that the Roman Empire, with all of its armies and all of its strength, that it rules and it reigns and it wins? Could it be that my neighbors down the street who are making my life so miserable, that they rule and they reign and they win? And into all this comes this picture that John gives in the book of Revelation. It is a book that more than anything else when you read it, you've got to remember this. It is a book that declares that God rules, God reigns, God wins. When you read all the strange imagery, all the things that are going on in the book, just remind yourself, it's a book that God rules, God reigns, God wins. And in this book, not only does it tell us that, but it gives us the picture of what it looks like when God finally wins. It is a picture that was desperately needed by those people back in the first century, but as it turns out, it's a picture that every one of us is drawn to. A picture of a new creation, where creation finally pulsates with the life and the beauty that God has always intended for it. Now, you know, the thing is that we are often amazed by creation, whether it's the Grand Tetons or the Grand Canyon, whether it's sunlight streaming down through clouds or a rainbow. We are amazed by creation. But God says to us, listen, you think you're amazed now. My creation is in bondage. My creation is held up. There is going to be a day when it pulsates with all the life and all the wonder and all the beauty. You'll be overwhelmed by it. When God wins, creation finally becomes what it's supposed to be. When God wins, people finally become what they're supposed to be. No more conflict. No more seventh grade girl catfights. No more people who just will not get along, refuse to get along. But more than that, on that day, those who have spent their lives mentally impaired or physically impaired will run and leap and jump. And those who have never spoken a word will go to their caregivers and say, "Thank you." And on that day, those whose bodies have been wasted by cancer and by disease will be made whole and complete again. It is a day when creation becomes what it's supposed to be and people become what they're supposed to be. And in a way that we do not understand, nations become what they're supposed to be. Nations will not take up sword against nation anymore. They will take their swords and beat them into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and they will not prepare for war anymore. Palestinians and Jews will come together, Iranians and Americans, North Koreans and South Koreans. And nations will do and be what they're supposed to do and be. It will be a day when there is this creation the way it's supposed to be, and people the way they're supposed to be, and nations the way they're supposed to be, and there will no longer be any sea. That's what John tells us. He says the former things have passed away. There's no longer any sea. And some of us go, what do you mean no longer any sea? I love the beach. Lose the sea? That doesn't seem like a very great place to be. What we have to understand is that the sea back in John's day represents chaos and fear and terror and rage. If you think about waves crashing against rocks and all those kind of things, people said that is the place of terror and rage and fear. It is the place of the abyss. It's the place of hell. And John says, that's going to be gone. No more rage, no more fear, no more terror, no more abyss. And at the center of all of this is God. Where we finally get to see God face to face. This God who we, like those people back in the first century, sometimes wonder about. We sometimes say, God, really, do you reign? Do you rule? Do you win? Really, God, are you a God of kindness? Are you a God of mercy? Are you a God of justice? It doesn't feel that way. And for more than a few of us, we just struggle with whether God exists at all. Whether we're just trusting in a phantom, and it can be for a day, it can be for a week, it can be for a long period of time, that we just struggle with God and everything about him. And on this day, when the new Jerusalem comes, when God's great city is here, we will see him face to face. And we will know that God rules and God reigns and God wins, and that he is a God of kindness and mercy and justice and goodness and faithfulness. On that day, in that city. One contemporary testimony takes the biblical teaching and turns it into these wonderful words. With the whole creation, we wait patiently for the purifying fire of judgment. For then we will see the Lord face to face. He will heal our hurts, end our wars, and set the crooked straight. Then we will join in the new song to the Lamb without blemish, who made us a kingdom and priests. God will be all in all. Righteousness and peace will flourish. Everything will be made new, and everyone will see at last that our world belongs to God. God's great new city. We begin in a garden. We end in a city where we and all of creation are redeemed, liberated, made new. A little bit more about this city. And that is that when you hear the words of the book of Revelation, it says that I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. The new Jerusalem's coming down out of heaven. Where is it going to end up? It's going to end up on earth. The new Jerusalem find its permanent resting place, its permanent place to be on earth. Now, sometimes when you talk to people, they'll say to you, well, you know what? What's going to happen is the earth is going to burn up. There's going to be nothing left, and God's going to burn the earth, and he's going to take us up into heaven with him, and we're going to spend our eternities in heaven. And they get that teaching at least in part from the scripture. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, it says this, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. Now, when you first hear that, it really sounds like God's going to come in with fire, burn up the earth, destroy the whole place, and we're going to kind of go off into lofty clouds of heaven and maybe, you know, have harps or whatever and spend our eternity with him that way. But you have to be really careful in 2 Peter, because Peter uses exactly the same kind of phrases and words and Greek words when he describes something just a little bit before, when he says that God destroyed the world with a flood during Noah's day. And we know that what God did during Noah's day was that he cleansed the earth of evil and unrighteousness and then renewed that earth and called Noah once again to start the great work of cultural formation. And so when we read in 2 Peter that God's going to do all this destruction and so on, we've got to be careful not to say, oh, that means he's going to get rid of the earth. You know what? If God has to get rid of the earth, God loses. Because what that says is that evil has so overwhelmed that he cannot redeem, renew, and make his earth new again. If God's got to get rid of the earth, he is not win, he has lost. But the thing is this, God doesn't destroy the earth. Instead, he does for the earth exactly what he does for his people, what he does for you and me, for those who believe in him. He says, I'm going to redeem it. I'm going to make it new. I'm going to liberate it. He does for his new earth what he does for the church through Jesus Christ. And that is, he says, I'm going to take this bride, the church, and I'm going to make her holy and radiant and beautiful. And he says, I'm going to do the same thing with my creation, this creation that's groaning under the weight of sin, according to Romans 8. And I'm going to take it and I'm going to make it holy and beautiful and wonderful. And when I do that, I am declaring to everyone and everything that I win in everything. There's another reason why it's important to us that we're going to spend our eternity on earth, this renewed, wonderful, made new place. And it goes back all the way to the garden. See, back in the garden, we were given a task. We were given something we were supposed to do. We read about it in Genesis chapter 1. With these words, so God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. God says, I've got a task for you. What I want you to do is I want you to uncover the riches and the wonders and the glories of my creation. You are going to be, if you will, co-creators with me. I started this world, I built this world, but I did not finish this world. And now you're going to be co-creators. You're going to cover the wonders and the glories and the riches of this creation for the good of humankind, for the good of the creation, and for my glory. In other words, you cannot be who you're supposed to be without land. You are a landed people. People of Israel understood this. They saw how God worked so hard to bring them out of the land of Egypt into the land of Canaan so that they could be God's people fully. And when they got to the land of Canaan, God did not say to them, what I want you to do is spend 7 days a week singing songs to me, worshiping me by doing sacrifices and by being at the temple. He wanted them to sing songs. He wanted them to worship. He wanted them to bring sacrifices. But he said, that's not your 24-7 job. Your 24-7 job is this. In this land I've given you, treat people the way you're supposed to treat them. Do justice. Love kindness. In the land, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to treat the land rightly. Lots of words about how people are supposed to treat the land. And in this place, you are to treat animals of all things rightly. If you go through the Bible, you find out how you're supposed to treat animals and how you're supposed to treat the land and how you're supposed to treat one another. To do all of these things, you've got to be a people of the land. In the New Testament, Jesus says that the meek will inherit the earth. To be who we're supposed to be, we need a place. Why would we imagine that when God says to us, listen, for you to truly be who you're supposed to be, you've got to be connected to a place, that when we get to the new creation, he'd say, oh, change my mind. All you need are clouds and a harp and you're good to go. Now, we're not exactly sure how or what God calls us to be or what God will call us to be in this new creation. What we do know is that he calls us in this new creation to worship him, to serve him, and to reign with him. David Lawrence, in his book, Heaven, It's Not the End of the World, writes these words. It may well be that like Adam and Eve, we are commissioned to steward and develop the new earth, a new world of resources to discover and harness, new vistas of beauty to capture in paintings, poetry, and song, every new discovery the occasion of a great outburst of praise and worship to the one who revealed it and created it. This kind of new earth is exciting. It's far from traditional views of heaven that have led many Christians to wonder whether they will enjoy eternity when the first flush of relief at getting there has passed. Small groups, as you continue the conversation around this sermon, you're going to talk about that, about what a difference it makes if you understand that in this new creation, we are called to continue this mandate of God to discover the riches of the earth and to develop them and be co-creators with God, even in the new heavens and the new earth. This Jerusalem is a landed place. This Jerusalem is also a place of phenomenal beauty. As a matter of fact, it is so beautiful that if you go to Revelation chapter 21, verses 9 through 21, you'll discover there that John is just trying to grab at any image he possibly can get to help us understand just how beautiful it is. He talks about gates being made of single pearls. Where in the world do you get a pearl big enough to make a gate? He talks about walls of diamonds. He talks about streets of gold, but he says it's pure gold that you can see through like glass. What is that? I mean, when was the last time you looked at gold and could see through it? He is just struggling to try to get our minds around a place that is so overwhelmingly beautiful that we simply cannot really picture it. But there's another reason as well why this place is so beautiful. It's a reason that we read about in Revelation 21, where it says this: the nations will walk by the light of the city, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. If you go back to Isaiah 60 in the Old Testament, you read something very similar. And the idea is just this: that the wealth of the nations, the great things, the great art, the great music, the great science, the great technology, those things will somehow be redeemed and brought into the new city. And will bring beauty and joy into that new city as people see them, absorb them, stand in wonder at them. This new city is going to carry the wealth of the nations. Again, back to David Lawrence and what he says: will all that has been achieved in centuries of human achievement be lost in the fire of judgment? Will God wipe out progress in science, technology, and the arts? Or could it be that this very progress will itself be redeemed and granted a place in the new earth? It is a very narrow view of God's involvement in this world which maintains all that he is interested in is the salvation of our souls. God is the God of all creation. The earth was not just a disposable space station on which God would work out his salvation mission, but it was, and still is, his creation. And at every step of its development, he has been sustaining it. I am sure that many great works of art, architecture, and music, along with scientific discoveries and technological advances, have delighted the heart of God. As Abraham Kuyper wrote, we may conclude that the knowledge and dominion we have gained over nature here can and will be of significance even in the kingdom of glory. Small groups, as you continue your conversation, that's another thing you're going to talk about. How does it change your priority as an individual, as a small group, or the priorities of Evergreen when we understand that some of the things we create, maybe some of these pieces of art, are going to find their way into the New Jerusalem? How does that change how you treat things now, what your priorities are now? I think of quilts that my sister-in-law makes and the beauty of those quilts. And I can't help but wonder if some of them are going to show up in the New Jerusalem. What is it that you do? Small groups, individuals, what is it that you might be thinking about that might you change your priorities? Say, you know what, those things are going to be done in a way that they're going to end up in the New Jerusalem. This New Jerusalem is a place where God declares that he wins. It's a place that declares that he rules and he reigns. It's a place where we serve It's a place of beauty. It's a place where people become what they're supposed to be, and creation becomes what it's supposed to be, and there is no longer any sea, and we finally get to see God face to face. It is this amazing and wonderful place that we look forward to, but it is more than that. Because the picture of the new city teaches us how to live in the city now. This picture of the new city teaches us how to live in the city now. It teaches us how to give the cities that we are a part of, whether small cities or medium-sized cities or large cities, whatever it may be, it teaches us how to give those cities just a little win of the New Jerusalem right now. Think about it like this. There is a basketball coach at a well-known U.S. university. And every year he has his first meeting for his basketball players. And the rookies who go to that first meeting know exactly what to expect. They're going to walk in, and there are going to be some videos that teach them about other teams. There's going to be scouting reports. There's going to be a playbook. Everything is going to be set up so that they can start learning how to play together as a team so that they can get out there and they can win games. They know what to expect. When they walk into the first meeting, though, they're blown away because none of those things are present. Instead, what they see are tables with fine linen on them. And bone china, and silver, and crystal. And then this woman walks in who is meticulously dressed, and she starts teaching them. She says, this is how you take your napkin off the table and put it on your lap. This is how you ask for the salt. This is the first fork that you use. This is the first piece of crystal that you use. And she lays all that out for them, and then they are served this sumptuous meal where they have to do everything they've just learned. At the end of the meal, the coach gets up and he says to them, now, this is what you need to know. When a team wins the NCAA Division I, they are invited to the White House for a dinner with the president. I want you to know how to act when you get there. We need to look down to know what we're supposed to do, what that new Jerusalem looks like, and we need to start acting that way now. And at the heart of acting that way now is the knowledge that our mission is not only to defeat sin in people's lives, but it is to defeat sin in societies, in the arts, in business, in sports, in cultural expressions. It's not just to defeat sin in people's lives, as important that is, it is also to defeat sin in the arts, in business, in cultural expressions, in societies, in people's lives. And you know, you hear that, and it feels like this really huge thing, right? It's kind of like, how in the world? I mean, I have a hard enough time talking to people about Jesus, and now you're saying to me, you ought to start helping defeat sin in people's lives and in cultures and all that. How in the world can I pull that off? That's above my pay grade. Well, you know, it does sound really hard. But here's the deal. If we are willing to keep our eyes open on our street, in our neighborhood, in our community, in our city, just keep our eyes open and ask, what is one thing, just one thing, not a dozen things, not 20 things, what is one thing that I can do to give my street, my neighborhood, my community a taste of the New Jerusalem? What one piece of art might give a little taste of the New Jerusalem? What 3 hours of my time on a Saturday morning for Love Your Neighbor Day might give my community a taste of the New Jerusalem? What one thing might my neighbor need to give them a taste? And as you give a taste, and as you will, if you will, you give one taste this year, one taste next year, and it begins to build up, the world looks a little bit more and a little bit more like that New Jerusalem. Just little things, over and over again. South Dakota. Minor County, South Dakota. Minor County, South Dakota is a place that is, well, has been losing population. It's one of those kind of farm areas, you know, people move out, they don't move back in. And in Minor County, South Dakota, the high school students were doing a study on what happens to rural communities when they start to shrink and how those places begin to die. And these kids in Minor County said, you know, we don't want our county, we don't want our area to die. So we need to figure out something we can do to keep this place alive, to keep people coming back. Now, they could look over Minor County and they could see 100 different things to do. But when they did their study, they decided on just one. And what they did was they called the people of Minor County together, and the place is small enough that, you know, if high school students are doing something, people better show up. And so people showed up. And they did their whole presentation. The high school students did their whole presentation. And they got to the end of the presentation, and they said, you know what, if you will do one thing, it will make a huge difference. What we've discovered is that people are traveling from Minor County 60 miles to Sioux Falls. And they're going to the big box stores, and they're spending their money in the big box stores. Now, you don't have to stop doing that, but if you will spend just 10% more of your income in Minor County, it will add $7 million to our economy. The next year, South Dakota's Board of Statistics came out with an amazing thing. They discovered that spending in Minor County had gone up $15.4 million. And along with that came an increase in tax base that allowed the government to do much more of what it had hoped to do for years but could never do. And along with that came people who started saying, listen, if we can do this, we can start doing that. And it was just from some high school students who said, you know what, if you'll just spend 10% back here in Minor County, just one thing, just one. The task can seem overwhelming. But if we are willing to keep our eyes open and ask, what one thing, just one, might I do, might my small group do, might Evergreen do, to give our neighborhood, our community, our city, one thing. We begin in a garden. We end in a city where we are redeemed, liberated, made new. It is this amazing thing to look forward to where people are supposed, what they're supposed to be in creation, what it is supposed to be, and all is put together. But as we look forward, we can never look beyond where we are, knowing that we are called now to our city and to our place. Knowing that we are called now to show this world what it looks like when God wins. Father God, we thank you for the New Jerusalem, for this great and ultimate city of God. And we pray, Father, that you will not only enliven our hearts with joy to that New Jerusalem, but you will, Father, show us how that city shapes and forms our city today. Through Jesus Christ our Lord.